You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the American League East for MLB.com Extras, checking in on the three keys to success for each club entering the 2016 season. We start off with MLB.com Blue Jays reporter Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, the Blue Jays getting off to just the kind of start that they needed to, that I think obviously they wanted to, and that a lot of people thought they would. They're 2-0 after two games, and it's not just two games because it's two games on the road against a division opponent, so I feel like that gives it a little more. And they also beat Chris Archer in the opener, and a lot of people think Chris Archer will be in the hunt for the American League Cy Young Award. So let's start with that, with the opener. They go out there, Stroman versus Archer, and man, Stroman looked like an ace, didn't he?
He absolutely did. And I mean, if you're the Blue Jays, you just have to hope for more of the same from him throughout this year. But he was about as good as it gets on opening day. And the thing that was so impressive to me was the command that he had. I mean, it seemed like he was just putting his pitches basically wherever he wanted to. I think it was 24 or 28 batters he started with the first pitch strike, the highest percentage of strikes he's ever thrown in a start in his career. I mean, these are all big positives that he can build off of. And it's not too often you see anybody pitch into the ninth inning of the first start of the season, and Stroman was able to do that. So if he can keep this up, the Jays will obviously be more than happy with that.
We knew this team would hit, and in the opener they got a home run from Troy Tulowitzki, and it had to be good to see him go deep just because the power was a little down a year ago. And then they also get a big lift from Edwin Encarnacion, and that was kind of one of the question mark, if there's a question mark, but a question just early in the season because he basically had no spring training. But he goes out, goes 2-for-4 in the opener, 2 RBIs. And you had mentioned you kind of had a feeling that he didn't need a lot of time to get ready.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, because he's Edwin Encarnacion, the Jays were more than willing to let him work through the issues at the big league level. And there's going to be some ups and downs over the next couple of weeks as he kind of gets his timing properly down to the plate. There's going to be a few times where he looks great, and there's going to be times where he doesn't. But the fact is, when you have that type of presence in the lineup, if he's healthy enough to go, he's going to play. It's not a situation where the Jays wanted to wait an extra 2 weeks, put him on the DL, give him more time. He's been in this situation before, spring training last year as well, with a back injury, cost him a lot of time. So it's not like this is completely unfamiliar territory for him. And, you know, anytime you can add him as the fourth hitter behind guys like Josh Donaldson and Jose Bautista, that's going to give some production. Some protection as well, and the Jays will happily take that, even if he's not fully up to speed yet.
As good as this lineup is and can be, there was some question about, and we've talked about it during the offseason, who would be that leadoff guy. And at the end of the day, the Blue Jays ended up going with Kevin Pillar to start the season, and I took a close look at his at-bats, you know, in Game 1, and I know he was 2-for-5, drove in a run, and then the pitch counts. Two pitches his first at-bat, but then five pitches, and finally 3 pitches. Is that what they want to see him? I know he didn't do it in his first at-bat, but as he got into the game, he took a good amount of pitches.
Yeah, you know, that's something that he needs to do for his career. I mean, the Jays have kind of taken the opposite approach to that, and Pillar's kind of taken the opposite approach to that. They're basically saying they don't want him to change anything compared to where he was in the past. But, I mean, this is a guy who the on-base percentage, even though he had a very strong year in 2015, the on-base percentage was still an issue. And you can live with that at the bottom of the lineup, but when he's at the top of the lineup, you definitely want more than that. You know, they're not – I don't know if the expectations are sky high for him in terms of that regard, but – anytime he can work a count a little bit, it's going to be a strong positive. And I think that's a really big part of his game that would take him to the next level. So any small signs of improvement in that area is a big step in the right direction for him. And it's just going to be a matter of kind of waiting to see if that actually plays out over the next couple of months. I do have my doubts about that. But if that leadoff, you know, spot in the order is going to give him a little bit more of a renewed emphasis on having a patient approach at the plate. I think it's good news for Pillar and good news for the Blue Jays.
I feel like as you head into this season and you look at defensively around the league, it seems like Kevin Pillar, Kevin Kiermaier, it's kind of like the race for that gold glove in center field. And man, Pillar got a good start, didn't he, in game two with the catch he made in the gap in left center field and slamming into the wall?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I kind of said yesterday, it only took him 2 games for his first must-see moment of 2016, and I'm sure he's going to have many more. I mean, that's just It's just impressive, the amount of range that he was able to cover to get to that ball, and just the fearless mentality he has in center field. I mean, he really lays his body on the line game after game, and you do wonder long-term what that's going to mean for his overall health and, you know, just the risk that he puts himself at times. But in the short term, how can you not love it if you're a Blue Jays fan? I mean, he's made a regular routine out of making these spectacular grabs. You know, last night was just another example of that. And I think the Blue Jays will certainly welcome and expect many more of those to come this season.
Ian, the season is underway, and if the Red Sox could draw up the season opener in any possible way, they may have actually come up with the script that happened on opening day, because it pretty much went as they would have dreamed it. David Price gets a good start, 10 strikeouts, gets the win. You get a homer from Betts, a homer from Ortiz. You get Kimbrel to close it out despite no real stress there because it wasn't a save opportunity. I mean, this is what we wanted to see, right? All the new acquisitions pretty much in action as far as the healthy ones go, and this team gets a big win in Cleveland.
Yeah, it was a great start. You know, it really was. You know, a freezing cold day, so it would have been a day where you could have made a lot of excuses. You know, from David Price's standpoint, it was either hard to grip the baseball, or from the hitter's standpoint, it was hard to hit the baseball. But in spite of that, the Red Sox played a really good game. You know, like you said, Price really set the tone. He came out blazing, you know, striking guys out left and right. And then I think, the home run by Mookie Betts really sparked the team early, because, you know, you didn't know how much offense you were going to be able to have on a day like that. And then he, like, just drills one into the seats. And then, a couple of innings later, he makes just a great catch to rob what would have been a leadoff triple by Rajai Davis. So, yeah, a tremendous start for the Red Sox in a lot of ways.
They also had Travis Shaw at third base, and we'll get into that a little bit, the discussion of Travis Shaw over Pablo Sandoval getting the nod to start the season. And Shaw came through in the opener and made John Farrell look good.
Yeah, he sure did. You know, that was an ongoing story in spring training, was, you know, who was going to be the third baseman, Travis Shaw or Pablo Sandoval. I mean, Shaw just came out kind of determined to win a spot. And I think he really earned it. And at the same time, Sandoval didn't quite show them what they were looking for, especially on defense. I mean, they noticed a pretty big drop-off in his range last year. And from their evaluations, he didn't really seem to get much of that back this spring. So I think the deciding factor in John Farrell making that decision was really the defense. He thought Shaw was going to give them a little better defense at third base.
And now, what does this mean for Sandoval? I mean, how has he been since the decision? And at some point, this guy has to get on the field, and they got to find a way to work him in, right, with that contract?
Yeah, I mean, Sandoval has taken it very well. I'll give him credit for that. He's been smiling. He's been saying he's just trying to help the team. He's saying all the right things. I mean, sure, it's got to be a tough situation for him, and that, you know, John Farrell will try to mix him in when possible. And it's very important for Sandoval that when he does get in there, he needs to do something. But, yeah, it's not an easy situation for a guy who literally has no experience as a bench player. And here he is making all this money. So it's kind of an awkward situation. And, you wonder how long it will go on like this. And, you know, it's a long season. So we'll see what happens. Maybe at some point Sandoval can win that job back.
The other big decision as far as the lineup goes was Brock Holt in left field over Rosny Castillo. And I think this is a little different than Sandoval, because when the Red Sox signed Pablo Sandoval, here's a proven guy who had won rings in San Francisco, had been great in the postseason, and they gave him a big contract. They gave Rosny Castillo a big contract, but he hadn't done anything on the field, obviously, coming over from Cuba. So I think it's a different scenario. And is it a scenario where the Red Sox could come to a point where they just kind of give up on Castillo?
Yeah, I mean, it could happen. I mean, frankly, I was a little bit surprised. I thought they were going to give Castillo a chance to play every day this year, because I really thought that, you know, you had to see once and for all, can this guy play or not? And I thought I was a little curious if they just sort of pulled the plug on it before the season even started. And, you know, Brock Holt's going to be the guy against right-handers, against most righties. You'll see Chris Young out there against lefties a lot. So, you know, where does that leave Rosny Castillo? I mean, right now he's a fifth outfielder, which is, you know, hard to believe that would have been the situation when spring began. I guess because they just didn't like what they saw from him offensively. I mean, you do like what he does defensively. He's pretty athletic in left field, especially in Fenway Park. He covers that well. So yeah, where do we go from here with Ruzne Castillo? That's going to be another storyline that's interesting to watch and to see like what he does when he does get on the field.
The Red Sox were able to kind of delay a decision as far as catchers go, and obviously they have Blake Swihart and Ryan Hannigan and Christian Vasquez, but with Vasquez on the DL still coming off that Tommy John surgery, they didn't really have to make that big decision yet. Eventually, though, he's going to be healthy. You have any inside thoughts on how this is all going to pan out with those three catchers?
Yeah, I mean, if they think that Vasquez is fully good to go and, you know, can help the team more than Ryan Hannigan at some point, I mean, I think they'll make the move, and they might be able to find a trade partner for Ryan Hannigan and be a pretty nice backup catcher for somebody. But at the same point, from an insurance standpoint, it's like, you know, you almost want to have all three guys in the organization because catching depth is so hard to find. And they could simply keep Vasquez down in the minor leagues on an option, you know, once his rehab expires. So that's an option that hasn't been talked about as much. But that is certainly something that could happen. It would be tough for Christian, but you know Ryan Hannigan is only under contract for this is his last year. So like I said, maybe you want to protect yourself and keep all three of the guys. I mean, Ryan Hannigan works really well with Joe Kelly, so that's a clear strength of his and something that he provides to the team. But yeah, you just have to kind of wait and see how it is an interesting situation here.
Now that the season's here, Ian, I want to go through your three keys to success for this Red Sox team for them to have a good season and get back to the postseason. You pick three. Let's start at the top, and we saw what David Price can do, and we know what David Price can do, but your number one key to success is the rotation after Price.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, what David Price did, that really shouldn't have been a surprise. As fun as it was to watch, that really shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone. I think the Red Sox are generally going to be a very good team when David Price takes the mound. And when a guy takes the mound like that, your offense generally plays a little better, too, because you're just feeling more relaxed and confident out there, and defense as well. I think that it's going to be a bigger test to see what happens starting tonight when Clay Buchholz takes the mound, and then when Joe Kelly pitches, and then when Rick Porcello pitches to see what these guys are going to do this year, because you really need some solid starting pitching after David Price. And, you know, Porcello, you talk about a guy, you try not to go by spring training numbers and spring training performance, but his numbers were so dramatically bad that, you know, you do wonder if something is up there. So I think that, you know, everybody maybe takes a, you know, breathes a sigh of relief when once Rick Porcello makes his first start Friday in Toronto, and maybe, has a good start. I think everyone's kind of eager to see his first start.
Bill, one series in, or no, it's not, right? They play again. I'm sorry. Four-game series, correct?
Right.
All right, let me do that again. 3-2. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Rays reporter, Bill Chastain. And, Bill, as we record this podcast, three games down for this Rays team. They dropped the first two to the Blue Jays, but then they come back and they win game number three. And, boy, what a way to end it. There's always rule changes in baseball, and you always wonder how long it'll take for a rule change to kind of step to the forefront. And there it is. I guess we could call it the Utley rule, because that's kind of why it's in effect, is because of Chase Utley's hard slide during the playoffs last season. But ninth inning, Rays clinging to the lead, and it looked like they lost the lead. It looked like the Blue Jays take the lead. But then upon further review, it's a double play because of the rule change and the slide into second base. You were there, obviously. You saw it. You were in the clubhouse afterwards. Can you just kind of interpret what the final decision was to Jose Bautista being ruled out at second base and the game ending in the Rays' favor?
Well, first off, I'm still somewhat confused. But when I initially saw the replay, I thought, this thing is going to get overturned, because I felt like Bautista grabbed Forsythe's leg, you know, while Forsythe was trying to make the relay to first. And then, you know, afterwards, you know, they did it, and I figured that was the reason why. Later, it was my understanding that the interpretation of it was that the slide was the cause of it. And the fact was that he was not able to, you know, on this rule, you have to be able to can't just slide past the base. And I don't know, I just kind of, I felt like it was the right call, but the interpretation was wrong, or and left me maybe more confused than I was initially. But, you know, the one thing I like to think about is the way, since Rob Manfred's been the commissioner and they put in some of these changes, I know several years ago they had the thing where everybody was having problems with the transfer rule, and outfielders were catching balls and not going two steps before it fell out. And there was, And they had enough sense to change it during the season instead of waiting until the end of the season was over. So I do think when they implement these new rules, they do a nice job of trying to get it right in as soon as they can.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you that I think it was the right call, but maybe for the wrong reason, because to me it was clear that Bautista kind of purposely put his hand up and tried to get Forsyth's leg, and it happened just as Forsyth was throwing. Now, the irony of it maybe is that when you look at the throw and the replay, if it had been a good throw and it had been, you know, caught, the runner would probably have been safe anyway, so Bautista would have been better off not doing that. But I thought he would have been able to stay on the bag as far as his slide goes. But in the end, I do think, like you said, the right call. Rays get on in the win column here in 2016. Overall, in the series, there were some other good things, or so far in the series, some other good things. You were hoping that the Rays would get some more pop with Dickerson in the lineup, and he's provided that. You liked the signing when it happened, I know, Bill. And have you liked what you've seen? A couple of home runs in three games so far for Dickerson?
Yeah, you know, and I've noticed, you know, you can't help but notice anybody who's watched some baseball that when he hits them and they go, they get out of the park in a hurry. And it was kind of fun last night. I was able to put this, we have this new StatCast technology, which measures, you know, exit velocity. And the one he hit last night got out of there at 106 miles per hour, which is kind of a fun stat. I think the I think Manny Machado has the best miles per hour this year. I think he hit one that was 116, but again, it's kind of fun. It's kind of like measuring the, you know, a pitcher's miles per hour, though probably not as important a stat as that. But yeah, he and the thing about Dickerson too, I noticed last night, Longoria came up with second and third, and two outs, and Dickerson was on deck, and they actually pitched to him. So you know, obviously, that could be good for the Rays if opposing teams are going to pitch to Longoria, giving Dickerson some respect.
Yeah, some protection that Longo hasn't had here the last couple of years. Pitching wise, I think the Rays have been pretty good. Odorizzi and Smiley, and then game one, Archer, tough luck in a sense. He seems so good on the hill, 12 strikeouts, which was an opening day record for the Rays. How did he get into trouble? What went wrong for Archer? Because at times he looks so dominant.
Well, he won't admit it. In fact, I asked him about it today. I said, were you a little bit amped up for the first inning? And that's when his problems were. And basically his mechanics, from what people were telling us, you know, the people who know these things were saying that his mechanics were off a little bit in the first, and that affected his fastball command. After that, he was lights out. Of course, he wouldn't make an excuse for that today when we were asking him about it, because he pitches in Baltimore, the first game in Baltimore. They don't play tomorrow. But I just think it was, you know, he was a little bit jacked up in that first game for, you know, the first inning. And unfortunately, the Blue Jays guy was really good that day, you know, Marcus Stroman. So he kind of shut down the Rays offense. And once they were behind, you know, they couldn't get Archer any more support.
Brittany, as we record this podcast, a nice start for the Orioles to the 2016 season. Not as far as the weather goes, but as far as the play on the field, as they open up with a couple of victories. And on Wednesday night, they get a solid start from Giovanni Gallardo, who obviously was a big key addition during the offseason. He only goes five innings, 89 pitches, but just two hits. He strikes out four. They get the win. What did you see from Gallardo in his first outing?
He was good. I think early on he kind of struggled a little bit with some command, and the plan all along was for him to go that 90 pitches. So people were kind of asking, well, why did he only go five innings? He was at 89 pitches in his first outing. It's cold. It's windy. They're going to kind of play it safe, at least the first time through. But I felt like his curveball in particular was pretty good. His slider was a little inconsistent, especially to righties. He felt like he did a better job with the left-handed hitters. But a lot of deep counts for him, and that kind of caused that early exit. I think he definitely put to rest a lot of the concerns over his fourth spring that he'd be able to take that next step, but certainly there's another level still there for him to attain.
So Gallardo good in the opener. Chris Tillman was great in the first game of the year, but unfortunately it didn't last very long because of the weather. Five strikeouts through a couple of innings. He was great, and the Orioles end up winning the game after the rain delay. But should this game have started when it did? I mean, it seems like opening day, you have your aces out there. If there's a chance there's going to be a delay that soon, they should just wait it out, shouldn't they?
Well, they did. They delayed it for like an hour and 15 minutes before it even started raining. So I think they should have started the game on time. But
there you go.
I guess the weather just changes, and it's easy to kind of look back on it now. But it kind of is what it is. Filman's going to come back on short rest this time now.
And that, of course, is the one thing that comes of this is he's not going to go the full 4 days before he gets back out there. Was he as dominant as those numbers in those first two innings, striking out five?
Yes. He was probably the best I've ever seen him look. Matt Wieters, their catcher, said after the game that was the best stuff he's ever seen Chris Tillman have. And he's pitched well before, but stuff-wise, I mean, he was in the mid to upper 90s, really attacking guys aggressively. And if that's going to be Chris Tillman, that could be huge for them.
Yeah, so random to have that kind of stuff on a day like that, because you would think gripping the baseball and things like that would be difficult, but you can't figure out baseball sometimes. One negative, I guess, that came out of opening day was Hyun-Soo Kim heard some boos, I think, in the introductions. The team wanted to send him down to the minors to start off the season. He had the right in his contract to decline that, so he's up with the major league club. If you put yourself in his shoes, I can get it. He doesn't want to go down to the minors. But to play every day, wouldn't that be the best thing for this guy to get going and
right.
get the momentum rolling and then find his way back up to the majors?
I think so. But, again, he's well within his contract rights to say, hey, I don't want to go down to AAA. I think the way that it was approached was wrong. You know, the Orioles made it very clear he wasn't going to be on the team. Dan Duquette said on Masson and then said to reporters he's not going to be on the 25-man roster. Really kind of embarrassed Kim. And then turns out they didn't really get a say. Kim has to be on the team. He can decline that minor league assignment, which is what he did. And for better or worse, that's kind of the situation they find themselves in now. And I think some of the guys, some of the teammates in that clubhouse kind of feel bad for Kim because it's really not been what anyone has expected that it would be so far.
Yeah, certainly a tough situation. And he's a guy that the Orioles, when they signed him, thought this could be our left fielder. Instead, Joey Rickard is the guy that won that job during the spring. And, man, he's kept it going so far into a couple of games. I know he hit nearly 400 in the spring, had some extra base hits as well. And he comes through with a hit in his first game and he had an RBI on Wednesday night. I guess the big question mark with a guy like Rickard, who's a Rule 5 guy, is can this guy keep it going? Because it's such a feel-good story right now.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what everyone wants to know. That's what I'm curious to see. Can he continue this stretch? Because he's really been, since day one of spring training, their best player, their most consistent player, defensively, offensively. He's been able to do the little things right. And you saw it again last night, the sacrifice fly, drives a run in. He's a guy who looks every day, every at-bat, like he's fighting for a job. And I don't know if he can keep it up. Nobody knows. I mean, he would be not just selected in the Rule 5 draft. He was the second Rays outfielder taken in the Rule 5 draft. There was one taken ahead of him. So that kind of shows you where he was on the depth chart there, also the strength of the Rays organization. But I don't know. Did the Orioles uncover a guy at just the right time? Will he flame out in a month or two? And we'll all be kind of talking about that one hot stretch. I don't think anybody knows at this point in time.
This is one of those great things about baseball that you see that maybe you don't necessarily see in other sports where a guy can just the right time, the right move, gets promoted, and suddenly he's red hot like this. And I guess it'll come down to adjustments because in spring training, pitchers aren't making adjustments to face you. They're just trying to get ready for the season. And now the season's underway. At some point, though, the pitchers are going to have a better scouting report of Joey Rickard, and he's going to have to adjust. Is that the next step to see how he's able to do that?
Yeah, of course. And again, I think we'll know maybe the next couple weeks, maybe the next few podcasts, what we're dealing with a little bit better. Right now he's new and he's fresh, and you see this with pitchers too, rookies who come up and dominate in their first game or two, and then the league adjusts and they can't get anybody out. So it'll be really interesting to see, but right now you're right, it's a really good feel-good story for the Orioles.
But we will start things off by wishing you a happy birthday.
Oh, thank you so much. And the Yankees got me a rainout for my birthday, so we were able to celebrate a little bit for that. And all good. Off to a good start.
Yeah, amazing, actually, that it was a rainout and not a snowout because it has been really cold in New York this week. And they were chipping the ice away from the outfield before the opener on Tuesday. But they did get that game in, and it's a game in which the Yankees looked pretty good for most of the game. But one tough no-call, I guess, goes against them, and things kind of unraveled from there. I kind of agreed with Joe Girardi on the play in the eighth inning where Dellin Betances has to field the grounder, throw to first. Carlos Correa clearly in the baseline. You know, what was your reaction to that play and the fact that the umpires allowed it to stand and the Astros end up getting a run? They end up getting three runs in the inning.
Well, I think what Girardi said and what I actually believe to be true as well is that Dana DeMuth said that if Betances had thrown the ball at the runner, they would have called interference. But because the throw was so terrible and it soared over to Teixeira's head and went down the right field line, they weren't going to call interference. Well, are we trying to say that we want players around the league to peg runners? I mean, I remember doing that in the schoolyard with tennis balls, but I don't think you want to see that in a major league game. So Girardi put the game under protest. There's no chance of going back and replaying that game. This is not going to be the Pine Tar game part two. But what he wants is some clarification from the league office. And, you know, that's the way the rule is written in the book. So you have to live with it at that point. But if there's some cleaning up they can do to that, because I don't think you want players thinking that they have to throw the ball at a runner to do that. Correa was clearly on the grass. I think that it's a tough call, and you're going to have those all season long. They're going to go your way. They're not going to. But tough to take on opening day, I'm sure, for Joe Girardi and the Yankees.
And it does seem like a rule that could be tweaked. I guess the verbiage of the rule is that the runner has to be basically stopping the player from receiving the ball. But that was a situation where he was basically completely blocking out Dellin Betances' view of first base and his ability to make the throw from that standpoint. So I agree with you. Maybe something can be tweaked there to adjust that rule. There was some positive things going on when Starlin Castro came through with the big double to drive in a couple runs against Dallas Keuchel. And obviously, Dallas Keuchel has kind of owned the New York Yankees. He won the wild card game in the Bronx back last year in the postseason. When you look at this Yankees lineup that struggled so much against lefties a year ago, is it better equipped a little bit to face lefties in 2016?
Well, I think it's better equipped not only with Castro, but having Mark Teixeira back and healthy. In Castro's case, yeah, they finally found somebody who can hit Dallas Keuchel. And I know it was just that first at bat, but a pretty good first impression to have Starlin Castro come in. And that's what he's going to do. I mean, this is the guy who came into the year with 991 major league hits. Now he's got 992, one as a Yankee. So I think that we talked so much last year about Didi Gregorius replacing Derek Jeter and how daunting the challenge that is. For Starlin Castro, he's just got to come in and replace Steven Drew. So I think the bar is set a lot lower in the eyes of the fan base. I think that you're going to see some of the things that made him an everyday player. I mean, this is a former All-Star, obviously looking to rebuild his stock, but there's a lot of talent in there. You don't get almost 1,000 big league hits by accident. So he's got the talent. I've been impressed by how smooth he seems at second base. I think it's still a work in progress. But as far as facing lefties like Dallas Keuchel, I mean, that's the kind of guy that would have chewed the Yankees up last season, especially late in the year. He still was pretty tough on them yesterday. Other than that, they didn't score. But I think that they are better equipped to handle lefty, certainly this year, going into the year.
Brian, how about Tanaka in the opener? Because he looked pretty good overall. It seemed like he maybe ran out of gas there in that last inning.
Yeah, he mentioned there was something about fatigue, and he also thought the weather might have contributed. I was a little surprised to see him pulled at 87 pitches, but I think that the rainout may have had something to do with that, because now you were planning on having an extra day of rest. He is going to go Sunday night against the Tigers in Detroit, but he was going to have an extra day there. Instead, they're going to push him up, and he'll go on the regular four days. So maybe you're saving a couple bullets. It's going to be probably cold again in Detroit. So if that situation, the weather was affecting him in any way, maybe you just want to get 75, 80 good pitches out of him in Detroit and then think about doing the bullpen again. But I think that you've seen a guy who has been cautious all spring. He kind of let it go a little bit more against the Astros, and he looked pretty good. I think that if that's the kind of performance that Tanaka gives, I know obviously he gave up the home run, but if he can provide that kind of performance, I think they'll take it more nights than not.
All right, let's get into Brian Hoke's keys to success for the 2016 New York Yankees. It sounds like a PowerPoint presentation. you got three keys to success. We'll go through them one at a time, and one of them goes right with what we were just talking about in Tanaka. This rotation needs to somehow stay healthy through the whole regular season.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's that's a given. And I'm not saying you have to absolutely get 30 to 32 starts out of every one of those guys, because I don't think that's very realistic. But if you can get a healthy Tanaka for most of the season, if Michael Pineda can give you 180 innings and not wear down in the second half, I think that maybe the workload kind of wore on him a little bit. You saw that last year. I think if Luis Severino can have a full year, there's a lot to be excited about his potential there. Nathan Eovaldi obviously was 14-3 last year. The ERA a little bit higher than you would have liked, but just a guy who was an innings eater. There was no concern about him until obviously a season-ending injury, and who knows what you're going to get out of the fifth spot. So I think that if you can keep those first four guys healthy and on rotation and cycling through, you don't have to get necessarily 200 innings out of every one of them, but if you keep them kicking the ball every time out, that would obviously solve a lot of problems for the Yankees.